Before reaching here, I wanted to get an idea. Well, let's step back. One of the cardinal rules of public speaking is know thy audience. So I asked, what's the audience going to be such that the essence of Bhagavad Gita is the topic that was chosen? So I'm looking around the room. I'm not sure I understand why this topic was chosen. Because I was, well, let's put it this way. How many of you don't yet have a copy of Bhagavad Gita as it is in your home and would like us to gift you a copy of Bhagavad Gita as it is? So if you're not saying so, that means you all have Bhagavad Gita in your home. Anyone not have one and would like to have one? If you already have one, don't say, yes, I want another one. Okay. With that in mind, that's what I thought would be the case. So what I'd like to do is not just essence of Bhagavad Gita 101, but essence of Bhagavad Gita 102. Because there's really totally new audiences. And I think this is newer, but not totally new. Some persons, at least. So, I think what I'm going to do is make reference here and there from Bhagavad Gita, at the same time share an appreciation of the whole of Vedanta. So Vedanta is a text that Vedanta Sutra is a text that Vyasadeva composed. The rest of the Vedas, he simply gathered the Vedas. Here's what the Vedas say. Originally the Vedas, before Vyasa did what Vyasa did, the Veda was one. And as Kali Yuga was approaching, and he saw what Kali Yuga was like, then he wanted to do something because people in Kali Yuga, they have problems that are ever increasing. Manda samantayo, manda samanda matayo, manda bhagya yupadrata. Manda means bad. There's a lot of bads in the description of the Bhagavatam. So when he saw that very difficult circumstance, people, their lives are shorter, their compassion is less, their spiritual inclination is less, and even if they have spiritual inclination, there isn't somebody to nourish it properly, they'll be misguided. And above all, they're always disturbed. So he decided that he would take the one Veda and divide it into four. It's actually one Veda. And along with the four Vedas, then there were some remaining verses, large number of remaining verses, and he took those verses, this is what the Shruti mantras say, that those remaining verses then became the fifth Veda, which are from the same source as the one. And the Sanskrit style or standard was modified, or it was a different standard, a more approachable standard. alaukika Sanskrit. That's so difficult, less difficult. And he then compiles the Smriti, the fifth Veda. So this Bhagavad Gita is part of the fifth Veda, the Mahabharata. It's mentioned specifically, without all the scriptural references. It's specifically mentioned. This, the Mahabharata, and within it, the Bhagavad Gita, it's part of this fifth Veda. It's as Vedic as the four Vedas, in other words. And the Vedas, the four Vedas say it. So it's expressing the essence of everything. But the essence of everything has a root. And the root is the cause of everything. That from which everything comes is the absolute truth. And there may be many other truths, but they're relative to the absolute truth, and something that's true over here is a result of a cause that's over there, and the cause that's over there is a result of a prior cause, and prior cause, and prior cause, and prior cause. And what's the cause? Whatever it is, that's the cause of all causes that has no other cause. That's the absolute truth. And the Vedas are disclosing that. So in Bhagavad Gita, for example, there's several places, but one really nice for example, comes at the beginning section of chapter 10. In chapter 10, Krishna discloses he is the absolute truth. He is that from which everything comes. Whether it's matter or spirit, he's the source of emanation of both. I'm speaking it slowly because it's good to let it sink in. And the message of Bhagavad Gita is giving some detailed information about both the source of everything and that which emanates from the source of everything. And then the sambandha, or the relationship between all those things and their source. Now here's a Christmas tree. You can see it from outside, and some elves up on the windowsill and stuff. And Santa Claus over there, and you know, the culture of the Christian theology is very prevalent in Western countries. There was a time when that was Judeo-Christian was about it, and now it's far more diverse. But the Judeo-Christian picture also looks at what's the source of everything. And the picture isn't different, but it's not so complete. Like so many things. So what I like the principle of creation. In Genesis of the Bible, there's the topic of creation. And it's interesting. In the beginning was the Word. And the Word was God. And God said, let there be light. And so there was. And it was good. He just said, let there be light, and so there was light. Now, within the Vedas, it doesn't have a different source of everything, but this is 102 now, how that everything comes into being is manifest for some time and then is withdrawn, and then there's a resting period, and then the cosmic manifestation happens again and again. Bhutva, bhutva, praliyate. again and again. So a notion of the Vedas is one of the five topics of Bhagavad Gita. So I'm doing 102. The five topics of Bhagavad Gita includes time and Ishvara. Those are two of the five. So Ishvara is the source of everything, and time moves everything, moves the temporary, everything that's temporary. So here's the Vedic picture of time. Now, I'll speak of the Vedic picture of how cosmic manifestation takes place under the influence of time. Then I'll go over here a little bit to what modern mechanistic science has to say, and then go back to the Vedic picture. And you can choose which model you like best, because they're different. The Vedic picture of creation is the one source of everything is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, as far as creation is concerned, this is not dealing with the Vaikuntha realm, it's dealing with the Prakriti realm, because that's another one of the five topics, is Prakriti. So, Mahavishnu, during the period of cosmic annihilation, he is the source. He's lying on the causal ocean, the Karana ocean. And the internal potency, question, when you see paintings of Mahavishnu, do you see the goddess of fortune massaging his feet like we see Garbhadakshay Vishnu or Shirodakshay Vishnu? The answer is no. Mahavishnu, he's one of the Purusha avatars, he has his internal potency within. Rama Devi is his internal potency. And they're enjoying, in the language of the Bhagavatam, they're enjoying their eternal pastimes internally. Rama Devi. And along with Rama Devi, during the cosmic annihilation stretch of time, which is a long stretch of time, all the living entities, now there's another topic, that's topic number four, living entities, jivas, they're within in the body of Mahavishnu. Because when cosmic annihilation takes place, all living entities are withdrawn and they come into this resting state within the body of Mahavishnu. The resting state is a state of consciousness. There are three states of consciousness, according to the Vedas. There's that state like when they're in the body of Mahavishnu. It's called Susupti. And it's like anesthesia. If any of you have had an operation or some kind of medical procedure that where they administered anesthesia, you know what that experience is like. That's what susupti is. It's not sleep and dreaming, nor is it awake, but it's another state of consciousness. So during that susupti period, consciousness doesn't become extinguished, but consciousness becomes held in abeyance or very covered. Not just asleep, deep sleep. Consciousness is still there. Because the soul is conscious, can't be extinguished, Krishna says. But it's a state. So during that susupti state, Mahavishnu has two compassionate desires. One, these living entities, my eternal parts and parcels, I wish for them that they could experience the fullness of happiness. And that's not in the present state, because the present state is susupti. They're hardly experiencing anything, like when you're anesthetized. He just desires, icha. He's a person, and he has desire. We're his parts and parcels, we're also persons, and we have desire. We're tiny, but symptoms similar. So he desires. And Rama Devi, she's his consort. She knows what her master desires. He doesn't have to even say it. And so she wants to serve him. That's what she does. And so one of the services is she assists him in making the arrangements so the living entities within his body can have at least the opportunity for the fullest limit of happiness that souls can have. And that connects with the second compassionate desire of Mahavishnu. He, at a distance, he sees the reflection of Rama Devi, sometimes called Chaya Devi, shadow potency, or Pradhan. What Pradhan is sum total of all the material energy in an undifferentiated state. Elements aren't separated out, they're all jumbled up. Like a smoothie. It's not this and that. It's just all undifferentiated, total material energy, Pradhan. And he glances at Pradhan because Pradhan is the expansion of Rama Devi, sometimes in the language of the Vedas called the maid servant, just like a queen may have maid servants. And the maid servants are accepted as they're there for the service of the queen. But the maid servant is also a consort of the king. Sometimes children are produced with the maid servant, not just with the queen. So, Mahavishnu glances at that Pradhan and he recognizes, like Rama Devi has some service, she also wants some service. But there's no service for her in this present state. I wish for her to be happy by some service. He just, icha, compassionate desire. Rama Devi recognizes his desire. She entrusts all the living entities and time energy to that glance of Mahavishnu. The glance has a name, Shambhu. And Shambhu, as the glance of Mahavishnu, carries the living entities in time to Pradhan, and the primordial impregnation takes place. This is the creation story of the Vedas. A little different than mechanistic science. And when the living entities and the time energy, those two things, contact the undifferentiated Prakriti, Prakriti starts to differentiate out into the 24 elements. First one that comes out is our dear friend, false ego. Numero uno. Even before there's bodies and activity and anything like that, it's false ego has got us covered, literally and figuratively. And then false ego mixes with the modes of nature, because the modes of nature were dormant, but by the injection of time, the modes of nature start to become agitated and activated. So false ego mixing with the mode of goodness manifests the material mind. False ego mixing with the mode of passion produces material intelligence. False ego mixing with the mode of ignorance produces the Panchabhuta, the five material elements. Now they're starting to differentiate out. Nothing's happening yet. It's just like a big warehouse where you can differentiate what's in the warehouse. Before it was all jumbled. Couldn't differentiate one thing from another thing. But that's the picture. There's further that comes after that. Lots of further steps. I'll cover some of them, but I just want to back up and say the message of Bhagavad Gita, the essence of Bhagavad Gita, is discussing these five topics. Ishvara, the source of everything. The living entities, part of what he is the source of, jivas. Material nature, prakriti. And then time energy, kala shakti. And then when things start to happen, it's material activity, karma. So four of them are eternal. One of them is temporary. The one that's temporary is karma, and that's the one we're most attached to. Karma is activity in forgetfulness of who we are because we become covered by false ego. There's steps that further in the picture of creation that result in Mahavishnu breathing. We breathe. That propensity comes from the source of us, from Mahavishnu. And when he exhales, universes come streaming from his body, little golden seeds. And the golden seeds contact this now differentiated prakriti. Its name is Mahatattva. Just give it a different name because differentiated, undifferentiated. Differentiated, those golden seeds of universes come in contact with Mahatattva and the elements start to cling. The English word used by Bhaktisiddhanta is conglomerate. They cling to those seeds. And the seeds start to expand and expand and expand. So the universe is, like mechanistic science says, the Vedas likewise say, the universe is expanding. A little sharing. One time I was at the University of Houston and the arrangement for the speaking was a little amphitheater for the ISGA, Indian Graduate Student Association. It was all Indian grad students. And the seating arrangement wasn't like this. It was, you know, like a lecture hall at university, only it was a mini one. It wasn't like a giant one. But, you know, they seated, little tiers of seats going up and up and up, so we, you know, the eye contact was there. And the topic that I had been requested to speak about, knowing the audience, was Sariputta's book, Mysteries of the Sacred Universe. Now, very soon, I can't recall exactly when, maybe it already happened, there was a symposium in Gainesville in honor of Sariputta's work, because there's a group of devotees that are his fans or his supporters. They gathered his written and audio and video material, and it was kind of showcasing it in a conference with different scientists who were also participating. Just recent. So I have been a fan of Sariputta also. Not easy to understand everything that he writes. But anyway, I was presenting Mysteries of the Sacred Universe. And one of the things that he says at the beginning of his writing is the way that we view the universe, the world around us, has a profound effect upon how we view ourselves. I'll say it again. How we view the world around us has a profound effect on how we view ourselves. So I presented this whole picture, and part of the presentation was that there's empirical information found in the Vedas that as technology has advanced, has come closer and closer to the numbers within the Vedas. Now they're not exactly one-to-one, but very close. But initially they were way off. For example, you probably know this, that the Vedic picture of cosmology is geocentric, earth-centered. Copernicus came along, and in cultures all over the world, China, it's geocentric. Modern Greek scholar came along and said, no, it's heliocentric. And then he posited some numbers of what's the diameter of the sun and the distance between the earth and the sun, and all planets are moving around the sun. And it was only off by a factor about 150 times wrong. Then as telescopes got better, it got closer and closer, and then now that they have, I don't know exactly how they do it, but Hubble telescopes mounted on spacecraft, and they travel throughout the universe and they take pictures. They send the pictures back, the scientists take their measurements, and now they get a much better measurement than Copernicus. So I can explain, I don't think this is the time to do it, I could explain the difference between geocentric and heliocentric, and in short, it's only from the geocentric measurement is from the point of observation, like where you're standing on Earth. And the latitude-longitude is where you're standing on Earth. So you calculate where the celestial bodies are, and thus your astrological chart, based on the astronomy of things, of latitude and longitude. It's geocentric. Astronomy and astrology in the Vedic picture is geocentric. But it doesn't say, in an absolute sense, the Earth doesn't move around the sun. It's just relative motion. So there are different equations, you put the numbers in, you get the same conclusion. Just a relative motion. So I won't go through all of that. I could take some time and do that. Because it's... most important is, where does everything come from? That's Vedanta. Where does everything come from? So when I finish this, in the picture of the Vedas is, we come from a person. Not we're robots or simply a machine. The body is a machine. Yantra Rudhani Mayaya. The body, it's a machine. The machines break down, you have to throw it away, get another machine, or fix it and get it, repair it and keep the machine going. But it's just a machine. And there's the driver of the machine. That's the soul. And there's the one that gives the intelligence to the driver of the soul. That's the super soul. And machines don't run on their own. Machines have to have an operator. They have to have an intelligence. And there's an intelligence behind that intelligence. where all intelligence comes from, including our specialized, unique personal intelligence. That's the Vedic picture. So when I finished this presentation, one fellow raised his hand and said, in theoretical physics, we know down to milliseconds before the Big Bang, or no, after the Big Bang, milliseconds, what happened? Well, it's theoretical, but we have their calculations. And because they were asking, you know, this is the picture of at the source of everything is a person. Our studies, our graduate student association studies, is without the picture that everything comes from a person. And then a second fellow raised his hand and said, yes, and there's two ideas of what happens at the other end. Like from the Big Bang end, then the other end is what happens as the universe expands and expands and expands, because kaboom, it just keeps expanding into space. There's either one of two things that happen. One is because gravity can no longer contain matter, it just dissipates into nothingness. And then there's another model that says when gravity can no longer hold matter together, it implodes back upon itself. And he commented that there's a contemporary scientist at Harvard University, and it wasn't Hawkins that just expired, another one, he had a TV show, likes the cyclical model. He said it's a Vedic model and it makes sense to me. And it's just his view. Time is cyclical. Expansion, and then after some time, withdrawal. And then resting, and then expansion again. You know, just recycling matter in different variations of creation. So I said, here's a model where we've spent, because we had already spent an hour and a half, the numbers are close to one-to-one match. The model that I just heard is everything starts with nothing, and in the end everything ends up at nothing. So what does that mean in between nothing and nothing? I didn't even give the answer to what it means. Then here's another model that everything starts with person, and everything ends in person, and in between we're person. The description of the model is quite different, but the numbers of how the universe is moving and so forth and so on, the empiric data has a very close correlation. Just in principle, the quality of life of everything rests upon person, aside from the Vedas says it, just the quality of life is altogether more attractive when person is at the basis of everything, because then there's love, and without person there's no love in the universe. And if there's some idea of love, it's just notional. It's convenient, you feel good, okay, go ahead and have a convenient feel good feeling, but really it's not real. It's not a pleasant picture. But so aside from pleasantness, the question I ask them is, how did the knowers of the Vedas get these numbers? They didn't have any technology. They didn't have Hubble telescopes mounted on spacecraft, go flying around taking pictures and send it back to the scientists. They didn't have that. So, how'd they get the numbers right? Without reliance upon technology, without reliance upon the senses and extended refinements of the senses. How'd they get that? And second, do you think people that have that capacity, however they got the capacity, are interested in fairy tales? in the same body of literature that just says, you know, like a children's story. Once upon a time, there was Bambi or Harry Potter or, you know, something. Alice in Wonderland. Not children's story or fancy or mythology. These rishis weren't in a creative writing spree. They're giving the absolute truth. So that's what's in Bhagavad Gita. The beginning of chapter 10, full circle back to that starting point. In the beginning of chapter 10, Krishna says something very reasonable. You cannot know what existed before you existed unless it's disclosed to you what existed before you existed. And then he discloses what existed before we existed. And he's the source. He's Ishvara. How are you going to know? You can say all kinds of things. Perhaps, maybe, in my opinion. Or it would be even more bold and brazen and say it was like this. And it couldn't have been like that. Because I said so. But you really don't know. An honest person doesn't know. But how do you know? How do you know the unknowable? By disclosure from that source. And otherwise you can't know. And then the methodology of disclosure from that source has a methodology. It's disciplic succession is the methodology. That's an important part of Bhagavad Gita. Parampara. Imam bivasvate yogam proktavan aham avyayam. Krishna spoke this knowledge to the sun god, Vivaswan. Vivaswan spoke it to his son, Manu, Vivasvata Manu. Vivasvata Manu spoke that knowledge, he's our present Manu. He spoke that knowledge to his son, Ikshvaku. Ikshvaku brought that knowledge to the earth planet. Now that's the Bhagavad Gita picture, and of course Ramayana picture, and Srimad Bhagavatam, the Vedic picture of how we get knowledge through that system of disciplic succession. Bhagavad Gita is disclosing it. Even for people who are unqualified. People who don't know nothing about nothing. Or think they know something about something. It's disclosure of what the source of everything is. So the source of everything has these two main elements, material nature, prakriti, and the living entity. So these are topics in Bhagavad Gita. So we've touched on four. The Ishvara, the source, and controller, once it's this is everything is sent forth. The living entities, material nature, and time. Now time is a fascinating topic, not spoken about a lot in Bhagavad Gita, but it's really important because time moves prakriti, material nature. For example, this is a nice room. There was a time when this room and this building didn't exist. Well, the elements existed as trees and probably some steel and nails and bricks and, you know, the elements existed, but it wasn't in the form of this. And wait a while, and it's not going to exist like this anymore either. Now you see it, now you don't. That's creation. Time. So it takes time to make the plan to build a thing and then build it. Put the plan together, get a license to do it, get all the materials together and do it. All that, karma requires time. Matter moves by the influence of time. So, you know, just even very simply, here we are assembled in this nice room. There was a time when we were somewhere else, and after some time we're going to disperse and go somewhere else. And we're not thinking time is moving us. What I'm trying to share is that the Vedic picture of time is time moves matter. Without time, matter doesn't move. And then there's different... Time is very expandable and contractible. In the spiritual world, it's maximum expansion. It's time is eternal. Time as we know it in the spiritual world is conspicuous by its absence. It's a nice phrase. There is no past, present, and future. But for the purpose of creation, let's go back to the creation picture again. Rama Devi has many subpotencies. She's the goddess of fortune. She has subpotencies. One of them is eternal time. And eternal time, according to the indication of Rama Devi, can expand as time as we know it. That subpotency has expansion potencies. So time as we know it is what's carried in the glance, past, present, and future type of time. And then there's really small circles of time, like, let's say, the life expanse of a germ. Short lifespan. But during that short lifespan, they do everything. Produce byproducts, eating, growth, dwindling, and death. Whatever that short expanse is. And then there's us, and then there's demigods, and there's all kinds of in-between cycles of time. Or now it's nighttime, and after some time it'll be daytime. And you put together the nighttime and daytime, and that's a day. You put together so many cycles of days, and you get a year. Put together so many years, and you get a century. Put together so many centuries, and then you get the life of Manu. You get yuga, and yuga cycles, and so many yuga cycles makes the life of Manu, and 14 Manus makes a day of Brahma. And then there's the night of Brahma that's of equal duration as the day of Brahma, and 100 of those years is the duration of the universe. And when Brahma's lifespan is over, the universe is withdrawn. It's really practical. If you want to be the creator of the universe, you have to know how to move time. So to end the universe, it's really simple. He just pulls the plug. She withdraws time energy, and the whole thing collapses. A really nice visual is during the Christmas holiday, lots of people have those, you know, snowmen and Santa Claus and something pumped up during the night. And then during the day, they let the air out. It's just this balloon on the lawn. And then at night, they pump it up again, and there's Santa Claus, or there's Snowman, or Snoopy, or whatever you have. But it's, so, the elements, they're not created or destroyed. Einstein was right. But they're in different phases of time. And the time energy moves according to the indication of the Supreme Lord, who takes the assistance of Rama Devi. She assists him. And then the time energy is withdrawn. And the whole thing goes back to its unmanifest state again. The pradhan state of the elements, undifferentiated, and living entities within his body. And that's a long time. And then it's time for creation. Tick, tick. Tick, tick. Then comes this, again, compassionate desire. And then again. And so in big cycles. And the biggest of all cycles is eternal time. There's no cycle. There's no past, present, future. So there's time in the spiritual realm, but not time as we know it. Eternal time. Like, what's eternal? Well, it's beyond our experience. Don't try to imagine what eternal time is, because the mind isn't that elastic. It can't stretch that far. But time is eternal, and then down here is time as we know it. You've heard the phrase, as above, so below. Anyone never heard that one before? The spiritual world is above, and below is here. As above, so below. So whatever exists here, we can know. The spiritual counterpart is there. I'll give two examples that I like from the Bhagavatam. Now I'm going into 201, Essence of Bhagavad Gita. But probably all of you are familiar with the Brahma Vimohan Lila. Brahma stole the calves and cowherd boys, put them in a cave. He wanted to see, he had this curiosity. It wasn't like challenging Krishna, but when he saw the Agasura demon be destroyed and the soul of the Agasura demon hover in the air and then entered the body of Krishna, he destroyed this giant serpent, and then the cowherd boys just went over and had lunch. And while they were sitting having lunch, he was thinking, wow, what's the extent of the mystic powers of Krishna? So he considered a way to examine that. What would Krishna do if I kidnapped the calves and cowherd boys? That was a bad idea. It was offense. It was very bad. But he did it. And so after he put the calves and the cowherd boys in the cave, he went back to see what would Krishna do. And much to his astonishment, he saw all the calves and all the cowherd boys. So he was puzzled. He went back, and there they were in the cave. He went back again. There they were having lunch. And then all of a sudden, each one of the calves and each one of the cowherd boys simultaneously showing the cowherd boy form also showed a form of Lord Vishnu. Four on Vishnu, surrounded by, and then the list in the Bhagavatam is very elaborate, but the spiritual personality of everything that's in this material world. You know, the 24 elements have their spiritual counterpart. See it the other way. This is a reflection of that. Just like eternal time and time as we know it. The three modes of nature, they have their place in the spiritual world. Earth, water, fire, air, ether, they have their place, but it's not material. It's the spiritual rest upon which this has its existence. This is a reflection of that. So how would we know anything about that? It's fanciful. But it's the Vedas. It's what Brahma, the knower of the Vedas, the discloser of the Vedas, saw. And then, poof, it all disappeared. All was Krishna. All that was left was Krishna, smiling, holding a lump of yogurt and fruit in his hand, smiling at Brahma. Because he wanted to see, so he saw it. There isn't a limit. It's unlimited. The absolute truth, Ishvara, is unlimited. Here, everything is limited. Time is limited, living entities are limited, material nature is limited, and then there's karma. So a big part of the essence of Bhagavad Gita is how to overcome the influence of karma, or the influence of our attachment to trying to be the enjoyer of activities separate from Krishna's enjoyment. That's what karma is. There's an intention behind material activity. And if we change the intention behind the material activity to Krishna's happiness, it becomes karma-free. That's a mystery. Now, supposing you don't know that mystery, even you read Bhagavad Gita, because some people read Bhagavad Gita and they don't understand that misery. And so they enter into this idea of karma sannyas. Just renounce activity. But you can't renounce activity because Krishna says in chapter 3, living entities are active. They're animated. Living entities within matter, matter's going to move. So you're going to do stuff. There's going to be bondage for that stuff because you're not in the proper consciousness. So you're in bondage if you do, and if you're bondage if you don't do. Damned if you do and damned if you don't. Bondage if you do and bondage if you don't. So what's the solution? The answer of Bhagavad Gita is sacrifice to Vishnu. Yajnavai Vishnu. So there's different, in parts of Bhagavad Gita, there's processes of sacrifice. Some like it this way, some like it that way, some many different, recognizing diversity within this world. The Vedas provide different forms or modalities of sacrifice, but sacrifice is the essence. And what does sacrifice mean? You offer to the source of everything whatever it is that you have, because it's from the source and it belongs to the source. It's the property of the source. You offer to that source in different methodologies or different models of sacrifice. And the highest form of sacrifice is the sacrifice in loving service. Bhakti Yoga. There's the essence of Bhagavad Gita. And then Krishna says, Arjuna, I'm going to explain to you how to do that. How to come to this topmost stage of sacrifice, or the essence of what all sacrifice leads to. It leads to higher consciousness. The consciousness of that connection of all things with the source of everything, including ourselves. There's no encouragement or teaching in Bhagavad Gita to give things up, like become a sannyasi and just give up all your worldly possessions. Krishna doesn't say that. When high school students sometimes come to our temple, we have devotees. I've done this, I don't know, several hundred times, speak to high school classes. And one of the questions they ask, you can wait and not answer it, or if you wait, they'll ask it. In order to become a member of this organization, do you have to renounce all your worldly possessions? Because that's a Christian terminology about become a monk. When you become a monk, you take a vow of poverty. Literally, like you sign, I renounce all worldly possessions. So my answer to them is, so you have to be a monk. They're not using that term. I said, no, you don't have to renounce all worldly possessions. But one thing you have to renounce is the misconception that you have worldly possessions to renounce. Because everything belongs to the source of everything, not to us. You can't renounce something that doesn't belong to you. I could walk along the street in a fancy neighborhood and see a Mercedes and a BMW and maybe a Rolls Royce and a Jaguar, and I say, I renounce them all. What renunciation is that? It's not mine to renounce. Somebody may have such a car. I know people who have such cars. But it's the proper consciousness is that's Krishna's property. And it should be used, Krishna's property should be used for the proprietor, Krishna. That's sacrifice with service and devotion. It's not renouncing in the material sense of renunciation. That's Phalgu Vairagya. Bhagavad Gita is teaching Yukta Vairagya. Arjuna, your nature is such and such, and engage in activity according to your nature. And always think of me. That's Bhagavad Gita. Yukta Vairagya. But an important part of the Vairagya element is, if it doesn't belong to you, who does it belong to? That's a very important part of Vairagya, or detachment, is Krishna is the proprietor. Because otherwise I don't want the headache of material entanglement, so I renounce things. I'm too frustrated with material existence, so I renounce things. That's very shallow and unstable. It's not sustainable. Sustainable is knowledge. There is a source of those things that are not mine, and I want to recognize the source through the medium of loving service. That's Bhagavad Gita's message. It's a natural position of the soul. So there's the essence of Bhagavad Gita. Again, there's these five times. If you read carefully in the introduction, you'll find, Prabhupada explains, one of our previous acharyas, Baladeva Vidyabhusan, he analyzed all of the Vedas, and including Bhagavad Gita, in these five terms. Understand these five, you've understood Bhagavad Gita. If you understand Bhagavad Gita, you have the path back home, back to Godhead, Punar Janma Na Vidyate. Ishvara, Jiva, Kala, Karma, Prakriti. And the one that's controlling the four is Ishvara. Four of those five are eternal, only one is temporary. It's a very flexible system, but it has, you know, the system has some standards that goes by. The yoga system, which is outlined in Bhagavad Gita, how you do asanas. It's not an asana book, but it speaks of asanas. It speaks of its role in the Ashtanga Yoga system. And then the topmost elevation of the Ashtanga Yoga system. Where is that meant to take you? What's the goal of that one? That yoga system. It's to come to the position, Shadhavan Bhajateyo Mam Yame Yuktatamo Mataha. Mind fixed upon what the mind does and what the body does, properly coordinated. Madkatein antaratmana, shadhavan bhajate yo mam. Those two things. That's the conclusion of the Ashtanga yoga system. Mind fixed upon the Supreme, and the body engaged in loving activity, interacting with objects of the senses for the pleasure of the Supreme. That's the topmost That's the mature stage of the Ashtanga Yoga system. It's right in Bhagavad Gita. There's lots of things in Bhagavad Gita. Just read it carefully. And because I'll speak for myself. I'm not accustomed. When I started reading Bhagavad Gita, I found, wow, this answers more questions than anything else that I've read. It expresses the questions better than I knew how to express them, and it answers them. But my understanding was like so tiny compared to just keep reading and hearing and contemplating and applying and, in other words, get purified, and a whole lot of other things start to emerge that you didn't see before, you didn't see before, you didn't see before, you didn't see before. It's a very special literature. And if I was asked to speak on this topic for this group, then my guess is you have a Bhagavad Gita study group here. Yes? Yes. So attend regularly. And you'll find truths. That are awesome. I was I recently traveled from New York to Chicago, and it was one of those, it was really cold. I was just standing in the devotee who was picking me up, they had to do a big loop and it took a long time. So the fellow that was with that, it was at night, he had that stick with the lights on and was waving traffic to tell him to move. I was there like shivering for quite some time. You know, like just a regular worker type of guy. And because I was standing there so long, he finally came over, he was curious, and said, looked me up and down, wearing a dhoti, he said, "You must have experienced a lot." It was like a street fellow, kind of, you know, simple guy. And I said, 48 years. I said, "Oh, you must know a lot of truths." And I said, "Bhagavad Gita." And he said, "Keep it going." "Give those truths to other people." I said, "Okay, I will." I gave him some prasadam. He was really happy. It was good prasadam. So just staying, living the life of Bhagavad Gita, the truths emerge. You know, we're covered. We know something. We think we know a whole lot more than what we really know. And most of it's just, you know, a misunderstanding of what really is. So Bhagavad Gita helps us get to what's really real. So any comments or questions from anybody? Yes? We have a little microphone, look at that.
Thank you so much, Maharaj, for the wonderful presentation. And I feel blessed to see you in Baku after exactly 2.5 years.
2.5, okay.
So, although the class went up to 201 level, my question size is still at 101.
Okay, fine. That's okay.
My first question is, so among different religious beliefs, so we said, Maharaj mentioned that there is no difference in the basic assumption, but the difference is in the depth or complete or incompleteness of the ideas presented. So I'm in teacher preparation and teaching program, and as I try to translate the wisdom from Bhagavad Gita or other revered scriptures, so how do I see myself, or how do I try to bridge that gap of non-different, but the different in the fathom light that lies there in my eyes?
Your question is unclear. Are you clear?
Me?
I'm not clear, but you're asking.
I can restate that. So as you said, in different religions, the idea of creation is similar.
Yeah, well, the similarity is there's a source of everything.
Yeah.
And that source of everything is God.
Okay. And then you said the difference lies in the fact that...
More complete, less complete.
Yeah, more complete, less complete. So being in a teacher preparation program, so my job is to... So because my students or me, I myself as a learner do not have that more complete knowledge. So how do I help the people whom I associate with in understanding less completeness?
Well, you can't give something you don't have. So you give what you have. And when you give what you have, you're honest to yourself and to them, as you're doing right now. My knowledge isn't so vast. But here's what I understand. That's one thing. Honest, and you don't speculate, just what you've heard and you've understood, that's what you give. And second part is, being in that role, you then feel more inspired to become more complete in what you understand. Isn't it? And so do that. You feel inspired means you go and not just you have more information. That's not what you're looking for. It's not going to be satisfying to others either. You know, it's a deeper appreciation and realization. You become more advanced in Krishna consciousness, you can give more. So being in that role of giving what you do have is impetus to become more advanced in Krishna consciousness, so you can give more.
Thank you, Maharaj. That just reminded me of something that was posted on your Maharaj's official website about not only imparting information, but helping people in the formation of Thank you so much.
Yes, in the back. The microphone isn't going to reach you. You got a strong voice.
I couldn't hear. What are the five names?
Okay, we'll do them again. Let's do them slowly. Number one, Ishvara. And then number two, living entities, Jivas. Number three, Prakriti, material nature. Number four, Kala, time. And then the temporary one is karma, right? So Ishvara, Jiva, Prakriti, Kala, karma. Someone else had their hand up somewhere. No? Yes. It's eternal. Sometimes manifest, just different states.
Okay. So it's like when you said about Susupti, so it's like when you talk about Susupti, it's unmanifest.
No. Susupti is a state of consciousness. Consciousness can be maximum illumined, consciousness can be minimum illumined or maximum covered. But consciousness is always there with the living entity, eternally conscious. More covered is a state of consciousness.
So
that's not temporary. It's a state of consciousness. The state is temporary, just like moment to moment for us. But consciousness is the constant. We're all spirit soul, covered more, covered less. But that which is literally temporary is karma. Now you see it, now you don't. there's the Christmas tree, and then it's gone. The cycles of time may move slowly or rapidly. Uh-oh. Slowly or rapidly, time is moving, Prakriti. So Prakriti is eternal. It may not be a tree, it may be something else and before and after. But Prakriti is eternal. The state of Prakriti is moved by time.
So the question I have is like, so when we say this material world is temporary.
Yes, we say that.
So
that means the particular configuration that it's in is temporary. You're a father and a husband and, you know, and that's temporary. You're doing those things, but it's temporary. Karma is temporary. Okay. Okay. There's the microphone. You ready?
Is Ishvara or the Purush?
Same. It's the same. The term means something different, but it's the same person, same entity.
In the context of enjoyer or the context of the
control. Yeah, the concept. The language indicates a feature of the person, one being the enjoyer, the other being the controller. But it's the same person, just a different feature of the same person. Just like you're one person. But you may have different relationships with different people in this world. Someone may call you some other, you know, different things. But you're only one person. So the Supreme, Vishnu, is sometimes addressed this way, sometimes addressed that way. But it's Vishnu. Ishvara or Purusha, right in Bhagavad Gita. Okay?
Is energy encapsulating into time or with all other
creatures? Prakriti, material nature, first of all, when we use the term Prakriti, generally, it refers to the gross elements and their configuration. More technically, the living entity is para-prakriti, chapter 7, Bhagavad Gita, superior energy, because we are an energy of Krishna, but conscious energy, thus superior energy. So that's just a detail. Going back to prakriti, generally speaking, Prakriti is used to refer to material nature, which has different states. It can be met, for example, vyakta and avyakta. And in that pradhan state, it's unmanifest. And then the mahatattva state, it's manifest as elements. And then the elements are gathered together with intelligence to make things, to make a building. Or Brahma makes bodies that can make other bodies by reproduction process.
So is energy encapsulating only in time or is it the property of as well as Ishvara?
In our common experience, yes, that was your question. Sorry, I didn't address your question. Generally, yes, but I made one reference, and I can give you some others, that those same elements, they exist in the spiritual realm. They have their spiritual counterpart. Everything rests upon person, including material nature. So their time is not active, but they exist in their spiritual identity. That's pretty exceptional. Normally we don't think in those terms. But I'm being careful in my answer because time isn't necessary for the spiritual counterpart of everything to exist. Time as we know it, past, present, or future type of time, is absent in the spiritual world, and all of those features are there in the spiritual world. You follow what I'm saying? So, a more definitive answer to your... A common answer to your question would be, yes, time is necessary for the elements and Prakriti to exist. But there's the spiritual counterpart. And then time isn't needed and they exist. There's another section. You like to read Prabhupada's books? Oh, good. Me too. So you can read in Canto 2, Chapter 9, where Brahma comes before, he does his austerity, his tapa, Lord Vishnu manifests before him in this vastness of darkness, because there's not any sun, there's nothing. There's the Garbhadak ocean and Vishnu. And he sees Vishnu, and he's come before Vishnu, and the verse, it's around in the late 26, 27, something like that, chapter 9. He sees the 6 and the 11 and the 24 and the this and that. It just gives numbers. But it's the spiritual world, and Lord Vishnu is in the Yogpith, the center of the whole spiritual abode. And then there's these personalities before there's even creation, upon which the creation rests. So that the spiritual counterpart is there. To say that God exists, he's not alone. He's with all of his potencies and his loving devotees, etc. He has pastimes with his loving devotees, but those energies are his also. And when it's time for creation, they manifest. They manifest here from some place, from the source.
So, time is not controlling Purush.
No.
It's Purush.
Controlling time.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. You got it. It's one of his energies. And even more specifically, go ahead, take them. Even more specifically, it's a sub-potency of Ramadevi. She's in charge of time. He invests that capacity in her. It's him, his energy. You're in charge of this. She's in charge of lots of things. And she has her sub-potencies to do those things for him. Yes?
Well, I have a question.
You do?
The question is that I've been working for with patients, and every day I see consciousness alive. We are moving, we are doing everything. But I have had an experience with patients, they are unconscious. What stage is that?
When they're unconscious?
Yeah.
Susupti.
Susupti, okay.
Because the soul, Bhagavad Gita chapter 2, the soul is eternal. Soul doesn't come into being and go out of being. And it's wherever there's a soul, the soul is conscious and consciousness. Interesting. Now, consciousness may be very dim. That's what you call unconscious. But the soul hasn't gone out of existence. Consciousness is just very dim. That's the unconscious state.
The soul is still
conscious.
It's still there.
Yes. Just like coma. That's like pretty extreme. But sometimes people come out of coma. Some people depart. Is the soul conscious? Yes. Covered? Yes.
So Maharaj, is that patient knows what's going on?
No. When you're under anesthesia, you don't know what's going on. Conscious? Yes. Very dim? Very dim. And I'll add, the sense of passage of time is almost zip. Correct? Yes. Well, I can detail it, but I don't need to because you know. Someone can be under anesthesia for half a day or a day, you know, something without details. I know somebody. They looked at the clock and they thought, you know, what's going on? Because like no time had passed, but a day had passed, or half a day, or so like. Anyway, the sense of passage of time is different under that unconscious or susupti state, but consciousness is there. If you're really interested in this and you want some scriptural analysis, Jiva Goswami discusses it in Tattva Sandarbha. That's up there, that's 501. But he's having some writing about Buddhists who were apparently still present at his time. Tattva Vijnana Buddhism is called, specifically. And they say there's no consciousness. Jiva Goswami refutes their statement that there's no consciousness in that section. So rather than kind of gloss over what he says, if you're really interested, consciousness exists in these three states. He gives this little example. Supposing you're in deep sleep, somebody asks you when you wake up, did you have good rest? You say, yeah, I had good rest. Means your consciousness wasn't vacillating between the awake and dreaming state, it was deep sleep. And you remember. Indicating you were conscious, because otherwise how could you remember? Anyway, then he gives some, that was just, you know, from practical experience, but then he also gives scriptural references. It's very interesting. Jiva Goswami is one of my heroes. Okay. Over here. We'll get next. Say it again slower. Your question is?
So what I'm saying is, there,
just the question part.
So how would you illustrate, or how Gita illustrates the ways in which we can move in,
to integrate the two?
To closing the gap and not to always have a conflict between our consciousness and our action.
Can I ask you for some editing? Are you using the word conscience or consciousness? Conscience, I think.
So, for example, let's take, I also teach, so let's...
Ethics, values, and conscience, I think is what you're speaking about. What we know we should do, what we do, or different.
Not only conscience, but I as well as consciousness. So for example, some people might know that they have to follow the right path.
Okay.
But not necessarily they're following that.
Dharma.
So there, yes.
That's right conduct. But that's not exactly consciousness. That's like ethics. Using it in a Western terminology, dharma is, this is the way I should live my life. That's dharma. And there's, anyway, so why don't we follow what we know is the right thing to do and we do something else instead? And not just why, but what to do, how to integrate them better.
What to do.
Anarcha Nivritti. You know the term? You're not familiar with the term? Sure. Anartha? A-N-A-R-T-H-A. Anartha Nivritti. And Nivritti means annihilation. And Anartha means getting rid of that unwanted thing. Artha and Anartha. Something wanted, something unwanted. So the heart has something unwanted. And there's a whole science to the something unwanted, how did it get there? But your question isn't how did it get there, it's how to get rid of it. Because according to the teachings of bhakti, it's not just sin, but it's anarthas, which are more pernicious or more stubborn than sin. It's anarthas, or it's the unwanted things that are in the heart. According to scripture, it spans over many lifetimes. We're born with impurities of the heart, and we build more of them, or it gets more, you know, diversified as we go along in life. So what to do? Because there's a gap between what we know and how we conduct ourselves socially and in the world. That's your question, what to do. Anarcha Nivritti. And in Anarcha Nivritti, the horse that pulls that cart, fasten the horse to the cart and the cart can move. The horse is Vajinakriya. What's that? Vajinakriya is, kriya means activity. Bhajana is activities that are meant for cleansing the heart. Shravanam Kirtanam. Vishnu Smaranam, Pada Sevanam, Bandhanam, etc. Dasyam. These are processes of bhakti that are part of the bhajana kriya, or the devotional, you know, sadhana, we say in ISKCON. So, how do you do that? Well, you have to best that you have a teacher that has good teachings. And then you go to the teacher that has good teachings and you learn the process of sadhana bhakti. Now it's right there in Bhagavad Gita, that's a good teacher, Prabhupada, but then somebody that can help guide you in how do you apply the Bhagavad Gita's teachings. That's really good. And then you do that. That's the Cheto Darpana Marjanam. You've heard that phrase? Cleanse the heart. Cheta Darpana Marjanam. Make the heart clean. So the starting with the process of chanting, but also hearing. And doing that every day. This is now Yoga Sutras. Do that every day. For a prolonged period of time with faith. That'll take you to the heart, the place where the heart doesn't have those anarthas anymore. And then there's integration between your consciousness and your conduct. The obstacle is the impurities of heart. We know what we don't do. Now many people don't know. But even those that know, don't do. Anarcha Nivritti. that's driven, that the horse that pulls that cart is devotional practices, bhajana kriya. And bhajana kriya, go back one step, bhajana kriya is best done in the association of those who are doing bhajana kriya, sadhu sangha. And the why that goes back from that is some preliminary faith. Adau Shraddha. All I'm doing here is just quoting in simple terms Rupa Goswami's teachings. How to get to where you want to go. If you want to go to this, there's integration between what you know, your consciousness, and what you, how you live your life. Those are the steps. Preliminary faith, sadhu sangha, devotional practices sustained over some period of time, good association, cleanse the heart, become steady and fixed. All with Sanskrit terms that accompany all that. So your daughter had a question? Fantastic. I'm ready for a good one.
So Krishna is like the Supreme Personality of Godhead.
That's right.
So he can just grow himself a tree, an apple tree, and get it. He can get himself some own water. So why does he need us to get him fruits and water?
Oh, that's a good question. He doesn't want the fruit or the water. But why is he asking for it? He's not asking for fruit or water. He's asking for love. Patram pushpam palam toyam yome bhaktya prayachati. One who offers me with love and devotion, I accept. Doesn't need fruit or water. He doesn't need love either. He just, it's his nature. He's loving. And he knows what happiness is for us, and happiness is when we're situated in love with him. He wants us to be happy. Doesn't need an apple. Love. He's loving. You have a, I've been watching how you and your mom interact, and you have a very warm, affectionate relationship. She loves you, you love her. It's clear. She doesn't need you to hug her. But, you know, she's happy when you hug her. And you don't need her to hug you, but you're happy when she does, because it's just an expression of her feelings for you.
That is so right, Maharaj. That is so right. That is so right. I mean, we just do, you know, like, so many times a day, you know, hugging.
I can see it. The affection is it's not only there, it's expressed.
Yeah.
And it's not like, you feel that mom doesn't love me unless she hugs me. You know she loves you. So, Krishna's like that. He doesn't need an apple. He doesn't need water. He just wants our affection. That's, you know, here's one way. As simple as that. You can be a poor person. Get some water. Get some fruit and offer that to Krishna. You don't have to be wealthy and, you know, a big shot. You can just be a simple person. Offer with love and devotion. And he's happy. Okay? All right. Okay.
Hare Krishna. I don't have any question related to Bhagavad Gita, but we would like to know also your time that you spent with Srila Prabhupada. If you say something, any time you remember with Srila Prabhupada. I mean, 5 minutes.
There's so many, just like, what's a different one or a good introductory one? I'll tell one I haven't expressed in a long time. I was fortunate enough to be on morning walks often with Prabhupada, and this is when we were living in the Henry Street Brooklyn Temple, different than the present location. It was a rented building, and the practice was Prabhupada would go for his morning walk at 6 o'clock and come back by 7 o'clock. In many cases, we get into a car and go to a park. But this particular one particular morning, there was a park not far that was walking distance. And it's called the Brooklyn Promenade. It's the area that's overhanging the Brooklyn Queens Expressway, and over there is the East River, and the other side of the East River is Manhattan skyline. So we were walking along, and Prabhupada was much shorter than his American disciples, but he walked really fast. So every third step was a run. Walk, walk, run, walk, walk, run, because he walked really fast with his cane. And then suddenly he stopped and pointed to a crack in the pavement and said, "What's this?" Looked around. Prabhupada, it's grass. Prabhupada, where did it come from? Devotee said, "Prabhupada, the grass somewhere else produces spores. The spores get carried in the wind, and the wind carried the spore to land in the crack, and then it started to grow." And Prabhupada said, "It's a demigod that fell from the sky." Then he explained this cycle of, you know, You engage in sacrifice, you attain the heavenly planets, you live there for some time, you come back down in the form of rain. So this is a demigod that has fallen and fell in the crack as a form of grass. And he looked at us like, "Whoa, oh God." And then to get to the promenade, it's this kind of narrow passageway, kind of like single file. You have to go up some steps to get up to this. It's a big, kind of like a plateau or a horizontal platform. And soon as he got into the clearing, when all the devotees could come around him, he pointed with his cane at the skyline of Manhattan and said, "It's all built on sex desire." And then dismissed it. He said, the dog is living on the street, and the man is living in the penthouse in the top floor of his skyscraper building. But their activity is the same. It's all built on sex desire." He looked at us like, you know, whoa, and then he just kept walking. He would, from time to time, just say some things that were so, like, outrageous and startling. I didn't get at all the sense that he was trying to dazzle us or something. He was trying to instruct us, you know, to connect with the Vedic knowledge and see as the Vedic knowledge would have us see. Because it's true, you know, the urban life is rajas, country life is sattva, directionally at least, and intoxication places and madness and crazy, that's tamas. But built on sex desire. To build this, he would say, it takes a lot of intelligence to build a big city like this, but it's driven by passion, driven by sex desire. And I think it was that morning, may not have been that very morning, but one morning, he was giving a morning class, and he said something very humble. He said, "My spiritual master found me in a dark place." And his voice started to tremble. He said, "And he somehow made me fortunate." And then he gave me an instruction. "You go to the English-speaking parts of the world, and as I have made your life fortunate, you make their lives fortunate. And so I came. And everyone went, Jai Prabhupada. And then he said, and now I'm instructing you all. You receive this good fortune and you go forward and make the lives of others fortunate. You know, drums and cartels and gongs and Krishna never forgets even the smallest of service that you do. Continuing. He said, if someone comes to his temple and they do even the smallest service, and his voice went up, they may even just turn one screw, Krishna will never forget. So we've created these temples to give living entities the opportunity to engage in some service to Krishna. That's our life. Give living entities the opportunity to again engage in service to Krishna. And Krishna is not an ingrate. He will never forget. Even the smallest service. Very loving. Many. Many, many. My opportunity to be with Prabhupada was mainly, well, mainly two things, a little bit some other things, but morning walks and classes and room conversations. And otherwise I was busy with book distribution, serving his order, connecting that way. Okay, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.